We are making the world's first canned university lectures. This lecture is being audio taped. It will be then audio edited at a later stage and a video essay added, and that together with books and books of readings will constitute a university course available for upper high school use and beginning freshman use. In fact, this course is given at Yale for everybody from freshmen through graduate students because there are no going to survive. I'm only going to take one room full, so I hope in the usual shopping around process, not all of you will take the course. Please go away if I discourage you at all. For those of you who came in early enough, there is a complete course description on a leaflet. There'll be some more copies of that at the next lecture. If, and only if, you really think you're going to take the course, the readings for the first lecture are here, and you can take one of each as you leave. If you are not taking the course or drop out, I would appreciate the return, both of the course outline and of these. Xerox copying is awfully expensive. Now, in the little leaflet about the course, you will find a description of its objectives. Although it looks like an introductory survey that runs from the Neolithic Revolution through the present day into science fictional material, it is not just a history. History of science and technology is not like that. It's not very much like history. The aim is to examine the modern scientific and technological civilization, and as an explanation of how it came to be, and a pretaste of the way it is going to work in the future, we will try to find out why things happened the way they did, when they did, to the people that they did. How were the ground rules of our scientific technological society laid down? As you will see from the course critique, this course is attractive to some because it looks like a nice gut. In the following sense, it's an easy A, but as they say there, it's an easy A if you work, and Mr. Price tends to make you work. You are going to have to work rather hard and in a rather freer way than you probably have at high school or at college. And there is the added inducement that this is absolutely non-vocational, and the brownie points of it will not help you in the slightest to go to medical school or law school or to any other career you may opt for. It's one of the things that you can get at a university, but not at a college. It is one of the ways in which I hope to get you to think new thoughts and to zap your minds. Please do filter in if you can. Why don't you go round and try infiltrating the other door and get in a front row if you move away so that they can. I think the door's open. Try coming round the other way, please. Normally, at this sort of stage, I say, of course, the only prerequisite is a reading knowledge of Sanskrit and Chinese. That usually gets rid of a few. But I won't do it. I'll wait for the second lecture. Now, I really don't want to waste time. For those of you that just came in, the new institution here is that we're taping this set of lectures to make a course of canned lectures. There'll be videotaping later on. And so I'm taking a little more trouble with it than usual. To that end, I would like you to bear with me. I'm going to lecture solid for a while. At the end, I'll have a question time separately. We can always put that, add that to the tape later. Could you please come in and shut the door, because otherwise we get stray noises on the tape. And if anybody else wants to come in, hold the door shut, they've had it. They can learn to be punctual. Now, the blooming of the space age, I think, occurred when we got outside the Earth and suddenly saw that splendid sight of the big blue marble that is the Earth. I think it is perhaps this that sensitized us to the whole global urgency of our technology, the problems of ecology, and gave us a whole new look into the future of man, biological, social, and political. That sight of the big blue marble, as we now know from later space looks, was perhaps a little too optimistic. It looks friendly and blue and ecologically safe, even if very fragile. In fact, as you get out of space and look at Earth a little more closely, or look at it by taking a high-flying plane, what you will see as you fly over most of the world is that the Earth is in fact extremely inhospitable. Even with all today's population pressure, only tiny margins of the Earth are actually populated, and very few parts of it are populated as densely as those that you're familiar with by the process of living in urbanized industrial society. Man is still a rather rare animal on the surface of the Earth, and in the past, through most of man's evolution, through all of man's biological evolution, and most of the social evolution, man was an even rarer animal. Man evolved as a large animal, a primate, and since the pack size is normally dependent on the size of the animal for ecological reasons, although the ants may live in very large communities, animals as large as man begin living in small packs. So man evolved as a pack animal, the pack being what we would now call some sort of extended family. There is a great deal of anthropological research on this. But the essential thing that I want to get into that most people do not realize is that for all this time, while evolution was working, man was an extremely rare animal. Out of the number of people that have ever lived, which is about 8 followed by 10 zeros, that's the number of people that have ever lived, 80 billion souls have been born and died, there are about 3% alive now. Ten 10,000 years ago, when there happened the first great change in the nature of man since his biological evolution, the number of people alive, I'll write it as minus 10,000 years, that is about 8,000 BC, the number of people alive was about 10 million. The number of human animals in the entire globe was about equal to the modern population of New Jersey and Connecticut. And those 10 million were distributed in packs, averaging in size something like 100 people. Now, of this large number, 80 billion that have ever lived, some 90% lived in the period before the big change that I am to discuss in this lecture. They were, as the conventional name for them goes, hunter-gatherers. That is, man in the natural biological state. Indeed, there were 90% of all of the world's population that have ever been in that state, and about 6% in the transition stage, which was agriculture, largely, settled, farming, domestic cattle, and so on. We are classifying them only apparently by their food, but really by much more. And then the remaining 4%, well, 3% are alive right now, and another 1% were alive in the post-agricultural stage of industrial society, urban, service economy, whatever we call the present or near future state. And if we are optimistic about man surviving for a long time, which I am, then it is apparent that a very large chunk of history, some 10,000 years, has been occupied by this rather small number of people, 6% of those that have ever been, who occupy a sort of transition position between the ancient biological state of the hunter-gatherer of mankind and the present population, which we are going to analyze in much more detail. Now, we can push it back a bit. We can make up a time scale. I want to just put it up because of a quite different reasoning that will appear in a minute. If we make a scale that goes by factors of 10, we start with 10 years, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10 to the 10th years ago, then we can put the major events in the evolution of man and of history on a scale like this. What is remarkable is that it comes out a fairly even scale. Something up here corresponds to the age of the Earth's crust, the coming into being of the Earth as a solid planet. Somewhere in here, an order of magnitude down, life began as a fairly prolific thing. We don't, sometime in between, it just started at the molecular level. By that stage, there is abundant life. By the next stage, the life has specialized, so we have the beginning of apes. By the next stage, somewhere, comes man in the biologically evolved form. By here somewhere, we have Homo sapiens, our own species. The big change that I'm talking about, the Neolithic Revolution, sits one order of magnitude down, and history begins, or prehistory rather. History itself begins somewhere in here with the invention of writing, which is what separates the historical from the prehistorical, technically. About 1,000 years ago, 1066 and all that, begins history as we know it, modern history, if you like. 100 years ago is perhaps the beginning of modern times, and 10 years ago is something like everybody's lifetime. This is just in orders of magnitude, you see. Now, the events, the things that happen, fall fairly evenly on such a scale. Biological man stretches from somewhere up here. Homo sapiens had existed long before. And then suddenly there comes a change. Now, what did not happen, what people used to think happened, in the mythology and fairy stories stage about the evolution of man was as follows. They thought that the hunter-gatherer, was a nasty, brutish, mean, dangerous, insecure sort of life. And in despair, man had a revolution and invented agriculture, and that led to plenty, and the world could then support more people, and they became settled. This is a sort of teleological explanation that we now know is quite false. That it is quite false is very interesting. What happened is exactly the reverse of the usual myth. What happened mirrors very beautifully the mythology of the fall of man, the golden age, the exit from the Garden of Eden, that things were beautiful before, and they tended to be rather difficult afterwards. Because this opposite view is true, and I will explain it in a little greater detail later, there arises some very exciting puzzles to which we know no answers. This modern view arose at an important conference of anthropologists and archaeologists just 10 years ago, 1966, in Chicago. There came out of it a quite well-known book called Man the Hunter, which is referred to in the readings for this lecture. And it poses the following problem. We really cannot see why and not how the Neolithic Revolution ever happened. And we need to, because it started the process of the technologizing of man and of the forces of society, that very clearly, once that decision has been taken, accumulate under their own weight. There is a constant feedback. After that primeval beginning pulse of a gross technological, social, and political change, those very changes institute conditions that make it essential to create further changes. One can understand that mechanism. Once you get into technology, as it were, there is no road back to the primitive society. It's a fairly important thought for modern man, because at all times in history, the most famous being Toro, there has been a search to get back to Walden, to return to the nature life. Now, the nature life indeed turns out to be extremely attractive. It is a mystery why man abandoned it. But having abandoned it, it is quite evident that there is no road back. Now, let us look at just what it is that happens and why it is a fall of man, an eating of the tree of knowledge, a going away from the Garden of Eden and the Golden Age. Primitive man had a great deal of what we would call technological skills. I would rather not call them that, in fact, because I would like to reserve technology for those things that we really do not share with other animals. And as has been pointed out, man is not by any means the only tool user and technology builder. This goes right down through the animal kingdom. Wasps, or some species of wasps, use little pebbles to hammer things apart. Birds build nests, and some of the seabirds drop stones on shellfish to break them apart. And you have probably all seen the primate experiments where the larger apes use sticks in very ingenious ways as tools. man is simply following this tradition, and it is quite apparent that during the biological evolution that led to the upright gait and the head being fixed in the present position and the hands being as specialized as useful with the opposable thumb, that during all this, many technologies came to the man-animal. There are some that are quite obvious, like simple nest building extending into house building, axes and traps for animals, spears and various killing instruments, and even at the very early stages, things you mightn't think of, like bows and arrows. They're very early. Boats. There are some animals that use floating things to float on, and man was continuing this, and boats go down to the through the Old Stone Age, predating Homo sapiens, probably. And then there is all the technology of flint. Now, from flint we get the characteristic of the Stone Age, the making of flint knives and hammers. It's a good stuff to work with. Flint is a stone that has a conchoidal fracture like glass, and this gives you very sharp edges that are useful for cutting. But it's not as simple as that. If you look at ancient archaeology, you will find that there is an evolution in the range of tens and hundreds of thousands of years ago of at least half a dozen different techniques of the knapping of flint. One went from the hammer stone use to an anvil flint knapping, to the use of a cylindrical hammer, to prepared cores, flaking blades, secondary flakes, pressure flaking, polishing, grinding. It was an evolving technology hundreds of thousands of years ago before this technological revolution we are to talk about. Now, just let me put up a thought to you. If all this is going on, what was the state of man's mind? What was his understanding? What was, in quotes, the science that went with this technology like? Well, certainly, any knowledge constitutes science, and as you will find, science did not suddenly come into being in the Atom Age, or even in the 19th century, or the 18th or 17th. There is highly significant science, directly continuous with our own, and posing the problems that it contains today, in antiquity, and now I suggest going before. If man could recognize the special stones that flake nicely to give knives, and specialize the techniques over hundreds of thousands of years, there must have been some sort of knowledge that was passed on. Another thing. The hunter-gatherer has a very much more extensive and varied food supply than does civilized man. The Neolithic Revolution destroyed a great deal of the variety and security of the food source. What is interesting is that it is mainly vegetarian. The primitive bushmen today have, what is it, something like 85 varieties of fruits and berries and melons that they eat, and some 40 varieties of roots and herbs. And once you get civilized and go into agriculture, the number of grains that you cultivate is very limited, probably far less than a dozen. Primitive man had access to all of the nature foods, so to speak, and the recognition and knowledge certainly constitutes the beginning of botany. There are also many foods that are inedible, inconvenient, or poisonous in their natural state. And again, very early on, long before the Neolithic Revolution, man learned to grind to get the husks off cereal. Man learned fire, not so much for actually cooking things in a hot fire, not sort of barbecue technique, but boiling. Boiling is probably the first of the great cooking techniques, and the evolution of that technology of cooking, out of which grew chemistry, also long antedates the Neolithic Revolution. Now, what is clear is that the word hunter-gatherer is a misnomer. There are still about 1% of the world's population that is in this original condition, so to speak. They're rapidly becoming extinct due to our own civilization pushing them off and not enough good steps being taken to conserve them and permit them to continue to do their thing, for the hunter-gatherer life is amazingly resilient and surviving. It can survive any amount of disaster, and it is only the considerable disaster to their world of civilized man that has gradually pushed them into a hole. And it is not so much that they have declined in numbers as that the rest of us have multiplied. But they have declined, and they are beginning to decline rapidly. We have, however, been able to go out and study them. And what is apparent in the results of this 1966 Chicago conference I mentioned is that their food chain is ecologically sound, it is varied, it is not subject to disaster, they have a very secure amount of diet. It is a misnomer to call them hunter-gatherers because they are about two-thirds gatherers in terms of their necessary food, and only about one-third a hunter, or there may be one-third gatherer, one-third fisher, and one-third hunter. Hunting was a relatively minor activity of man in primitive condition. You must not be led astray by all these pictures of primitive people in woolly sheepskins with sticks and spears running after buffalo, bison, and mammoth. This is not typical. They're mostly forest people gathering food and doing a relatively small amount of hunting. We can even measure the amount and get some feeling for the statistical mobility that goes with man as a wild pack animal. We happen to have the record of what happened when one large chunk of the world, the North and South American continents, which had been free of man as an animal, but had other megafauna, other large animals, suddenly at the retreat of the ice cap, there opened up the Bering Land Bridge to Asia, something like 12,500 or 11,500 years ago. Man then invaded this new hunting and gathering ground and rapidly swept downwards. Why did he sweep? Because man really disturbs and destroys the ecology and has to move on to eat, leaving the ecology to recover into a different state than its original primitive one, behind him. Man spilled into the North American continent, somewhere round the western fringe of the ice cap in what is now Canada, and came down running right down to the Gulf of Mexico, over the isthmus connecting North and South Americas, and down right the way through to Patagonia, running, 6 or 7,000 miles in the space of about 1,000 years. It took from about -12,500 to -11,500 to do it. And one can compute from the trace evidence left that this takes, about 7,000 miles in 1,000 years. They're moving some 7 miles a year. It's not very much. But this is the sort of range a human pack, in order to eat, has to have something like 100 people. It has to have that to survive. Because if you've got 100 people and compute how many of them will be of breeding age and how many mates there'll be available, at 2 or 3 available mates per person, which gives you just enough choice to push you into some outbreeding. I mean, below that you'll die out very rapidly. At that level, you die out only about 1/4 of the time. Most human packs don't survive, unlike nations today. Packs have a limited lifetime. They come, they go, they break up, they join up with other packs. They're evanescent groups. And these groups, of order of magnitude 100 individuals, that just satisfy the mating requirement and aren't too big to split up because there isn't enough food, for a pack that size, you need something like a 20 to 100 mile radius in order to have enough fauna and flora to feed you. But as you feed, you upset the ecology, and you have to move on while nature recovers. But of course, nature recovers to a different condition, because man as a feeder is a much stronger and more universal predator than all the other animals put together. Now, you can see that 7 or 8 miles a year gives you the rate at which people are killing animals. And it works out that if one adult in 4 kills one average size animal per week for food, you have to move on at something like 10 miles per year in order to get that much new territory. And this is roughly what happened in the sweep of man in 1,000 years from the north of this continent to the extreme south. Now, of course, that could only be done once, of man exploding into a man-free environment. In the old world, man also exploded. Now, just think how it worked. How did man begin? Well, somewhere at this stage, you're already familiar with Mr. Leakey and the Olduvai Gorge in Africa, the Great Rift Valley, the Omo Basin in Africa, where, so far as we can see now, it all began, or at least that's one of the places where it began. It's no accident that places where it all began, as far as man is concerned, are now today the world's most desolate, inhospitable of the areas when you fly over them. This is the aftermath of having given birth to man. Now, if you were to have been out in a Martian spacecraft round about this time 1 million years ago, or 10 million, or whatever it is when man is evolving in that Olduvai Gorge area, you would have seen that on an otherwise pretty sparsely occupied Earth. Earth is a pretty barren place. I mean, originally, back here, when life begins, it is as barren and inhospitable as Mars or the Moon look now. Don't think of there being primitive Amazon-like jungles full of dinosaurs all over the place. It is not like that. Life was very sparse. Most was desert. If you flew over 1 million years ago, the only bright green oasis that you would see is this rather plentiful country around the Olduvai Gorge where man began. Man gradually demolished the ecology of the area and thereby pushed themselves out into other hospitable places. Round about the Neolithic Revolution, something quite new was happening in the following sense, that man was gradually becoming more numerous. There were more and more of these tribes, and suddenly the whole structure goes crack. Now, let me return again to what it is that happened. It is a fairly idyllic life, being a man animal. Food was plentiful. Leisure is about 80% of the waking life. You need occupy only something like 20% with your food gathering, hunting, building, and necessary craft work. Primitive people, so-called primitive, hunter-gatherers, when we tend to be ethnocentric and give them a put-down. Let's try not to do that. The hunter-gatherers have a large chunk of their life free for leisure. What they do now with it, so far as we can see, is to tell stories, have social and sexual sports, organize gambling, generally loafing around. Hunter-gatherer man is relatively disease-free. It is the aggregation of man into large groups that gives you an ecology that can carry diseases. The primitive bushmen have in their society, without modern medicine, something like 10% of the population over age 60, I believe it is. Life is not particularly mean and brutish. What happens in the Neolithic Revolution is the coming of a much more widespread disease, the almost total abolition of leisure. Not quite. It remains at the 10% level or something like that. I'm just picking figures out of thin air, but I think you can get the idea. And what does man get in exchange? Why do this? I mean, when we look now at the hunter-gatherers of the modern world and we ask them, why don't you go into agriculture? Well, there's one very nice statement from the bushman of Australia, and it goes, why should we plant when there are so many mongongo nuts in the world? It is difficult to find the motivation in the face of relatively free food, reasonable continuation. If your tribe breaks up, you can always find another one and try and get your way in. It's been said that, I mean, there are two ways of dealing with the world not giving you enough, and one is to get more, and the other is to lower your needs. What happens for the hunter-gatherers is that the needs are reduced to a minimum, and thereby one has a very comfortable society. I mean, this is the thing that is mythologized in the Garden of Eden. Everything's there for the taking. Mankind is relatively happy. So far as one can tell, the hunter-gatherers are happy people. Sure, things go wrong. Sometimes things are miserable, but they appear to be the happy, innocent savage. Not quite. The Neolithic Revolution leads to massive work, education, beginning of cities, beginning of language, and that's another thing. And what about language? There is no way whereby we can find out what is the history of language before writing. The suggestion is that, in spite of earlier ideas to the contrary, language might have evolved very little before the coming of writing, and that is about 5,000 years ago. And that it is the coming together of man in this Neolithic Revolution that caused languages to come into being. Now, the mystery is why. This is one of the mysteries. Another major mystery, or perhaps better, a major change of ideas, is that on the nature of technology. And this is why I'm starting at this point. In today's world, there is a certain tendency to look at technology, to ascribe it to the coming into being of science, and to deal with the problems that we have to discuss of science, technology, and society as some sort of causative chain that the coming of science enables you to have technology and that makes social change. Here we are turning this argument on its head, so to speak, for what I am pointing out is that the best modern evidence tells us that there was this somewhat mysterious social change that I have described that led to the coming of new technologies, and that this then causes a certain amount of knowledge and technical skill, which becomes science, to come into being. This is probably the major way round that things work until little more than a couple of hundred years ago. There are major changes, there is more formalized science, sure there was an industrial revolution, but by and large, things work in the world still today the same way round. Now, in that spirit then, let us go back to the hunter-gatherers and rehearse the problem a little bit more. The change happened. What was the change? I would say that it is something caused by the biological success of man, population pressure, to some extent, of man becoming crowded more and more, so like a series of little water drops fusing into a puddle, the little tribes of 100 people come into such proximity that they no longer have the range required to go through their normal discipline of gathering and hunting and fuse together, necessitating the coming into being of settlement and of a larger social unit. Now, I have a hunch that the larger social unit has many things to do with it. I mean, it is this cultural change that seems to predominate and lead the technical changes. In the past, the stage at which so many Marxist arguments are still, for example, one sees a material change as the cause for all of the evolutionary pattern, that there was some material need to be satisfied and that made the culture change. I think perhaps it's more difficult than that, at least for this first change. Population pressure sure has something to do with it. The sheer biological success of man pushed mankind from a pack animal into a larger social unit, and this then required the adaptation of a language which had a more permanent quality than the private language of a pack or the call of birds, something that could be recognized over a large area, and behavior patterns that were in themselves communications. This is part of it. I think perhaps the variability of individuals that arose as a rather curious part of human genetics compared with the genetics of other animals also has something to do with it. Man is extraordinarily variable, and in leadership qualities for a pack, that variability comes to the fore. Packs would survive or die according to the quality of their leadership. Now, it happens that throughout history, the qualities of leadership have an incidence in man of something like the one person in 1,000 level. one person in 1,000 has enough of a quality to hold a group of 100 people together. That means that most of the time, in the history of a group of 100, the great bull leader of the herd is okay for the time being. His leadership works all right during the time that he establishes dominance, but then you get change of leader, as you do with any herd of cattle, a pride of lions, or any other tribal group of animals. When you happen to get the right sort of person in the leadership of the tribe, you get a long-historied and powerful tribe. You tend to get a leadership. It is those that tend to survive and tend to dominate. And I think it is possible that that sheer incidence of variability that gives you right from several tens of thousands of years ago charismatic leadership of a human group manifested itself, and this of course would cause groups to coalesce under the leadership of the big bull, the big chief, the leader of the herd. Well, such then is the pattern. I leave you with the question of why the Neolithic Revolution, such an inconvenience to man as a biological animal, happened, but it did. Now, when it happened, then we get to the next stage and can see the beginning of technology. Now, what happened was that you went from man as a free-ranging, nomadic, explosively nomadic animal, to a settled animal, necessitating the gathering and planting of their cereals, the domestication of more animals than just the dog. The dog had been with man from Old Stone Age times. More animals came in and were domesticated or semi-domesticated, and one looked for good places to do it. Now, the first stage was settled villages where they happened to be. But in general, villages did not further aggregate into towns. That is, villages, maybe 1,000 people, were about the limit of tribal coalescence. It couldn't go much further, and it didn't. There are a few altogether exceptional circumstances where a city did arise. One of the most spectacular exceptions is Jericho. I imagine if one was overflying the earth in a spacecraft about 10,000 BC and looked down, one of the singularities would be right near this end of the Mediterranean, this peculiar structure that you see on space photos immediately as a funny looking place in the earth's geography, is a big green dot. When you got down there, what you saw in the midst of this utterly inhospitable desert land was a very prolific, altogether magic spring that spouted up a great deal of sweet water and gave birth to a ring all around it. It was taken as magical probably long before Neolithic times and was a place of totem poles and cult worship. By 8000 BC, it was already settled as a city of stone, which was ruined, and a new one built on it, and ruined, and a new one built on that, and one has 8 to 10 levels of city, each rising on the rubble of the rest. One of the interesting things, by the way, is that in the work of the archaeologist, you are, so to speak, reversing the process of pollution. And what you're doing is digging out the pollution that man made in antiquity. And one of the heartening things about Jericho is that the mound goes like this, where these lines are equal level of time, and as we go up and up to the higher and higher levels, what you can see is that man polluted and buried himself in his own garbage less and less. So we are probably polluting less than ever. Archaeology is only possible because man originally left all of his rubbish where it fell, and later on began to cart more and more of it away. Well, Jericho is an exceptional site, and it's a very nice one. It's well preserved. You can dig it out. And the technology that is there is astounding to those who believe that technology is a modern invention. I mean, you have spiral staircases, weaving and dyeing and dry cleaning establishments from Neolithic times. I mean, the technologies get really rather complicated, long before the invention of writing. If one wishes to put it this way, writing, which begins slowly and painfully, something like 3000 BC in the Middle East, 5000 years ago, is a rather late piece of technology. Therefore, most of, say, half of the technology that is necessary for daily life came about before the beginning of history. By the time there is the recorded message of history, it is already too late. Man has learned to build weapons in quantity and sophistication, to build houses, to go through many chemical manufacturing processes, to do complicated weaving, basketry, several metal techniques, all sorts of things. Certainly many fire techniques. Now, Jericho is exceptional. What is the rule? The rule is, again, from your spacecraft, you would see the other really neat places on Earth are a small selection of river valleys. The river valley, with its fresh water, its automatic irrigation, and its built-in road system, available by boating, one of the most ancient of man's technologies, gives you the main road of the city, the water supply, the irrigation system, the sewage system, gives you all of your communication, and it is amazingly fertile. Animals come to it. It is a rich ecology. You have a linear city. And this is the origin of the deep cultural change. It begins in 10,000 with the aggregation of man. By about sometime in that first 5,000 years of the last 10,000, from 10,000 years ago to 5,000 years ago, there comes into being the great river valley civilizations of the globe. Now, there are only about four of them. There are only four of them. These are peculiar places. We all come from that. That's where it all began. It was not exactly synchronous. The Neolithic Revolution didn't happen at the same place magically all over. It varies a little as you go round the globe. The River Valley Civilization started at slightly different times, but not that far from synchronism. The great river valleys are, well, the most important two of them are the Tigris-Euphrates, which is now Iraq, the Nile, now Egypt, and the countries below Egypt, both regions of tremendous ancient ecological damage, the Fertile Crescent, I put fertile in quotation marks, is, of course, today's most infertile region. The Indus, the river valley at the northwest corner of the Indian subcontinent, what is present-day Pakistan, and again, one of the most depressed, agriculturally impoverished areas of the world, was then this rich, lush river valley where civilization started. And number four was the Yellow River in northern China. All roughly synchronous. We do not know how independent were the cultures that grew there. nor quite what contact there was between them in the earlier stages. The best thinking is that much the same things happened in all four places for much the same reasons. At all events, one had the growth of a linear city in all those places. It was, in a way, very analogous to the thing I see every time I drive in those wide open places out in the American Midwest, or elsewhere, you know, where the motoring map is lines that run north-south and lines that run east-west. This gas land, the city that springs up along the main highways, where you have a gas station and another gas station and a post office and a few houses, and you know the pattern. This is obviously how civilization started in the river valley. You had the only expressways in the whole of the globe. You had a lush area, and it leads you to a peculiar linear city. Now, the linear city of Egypt, the Nile, is about 550 miles long by something at the most 12 miles wide. That was the ancient civilization, a strip running on either side, actually more like only one side, of the road, of the river road. The total area of the ancient Egyptian civilization was something like Switzerland or Rhode Island. It's a tiny little bitty place with the people strung out in a line. The city begins in that linear way. But think now what was entailed with the city. As soon as man moves from free nomadic hunting-gathering of what there happens to be available through the seasons, through all the places in his range, and settles, the immediate problems are that nature that used to go all the year round is now very much more periodic, seasonal. When you plant, as opposed to finding what you may, you must get your big crops in the plantable parts of the year, the harvest. And you are then dependent on storage and the giving out of things stored. Your society has to be organized. You are into the culture of the city. You have the calendar to discover and obey. You have the power of economics, the storage, and the giving out of food to organize. This is the entire root of political power. It is no longer the leader who can lead the little pack of animals, but the one or the group that controls the access to food during the season when there is no other way of life. You cannot just go out and get your food. Now, that is the beginning, and it is only after society gets itself organized that way that the central city, the city as we know it, a place like New Haven, becomes possible. The city is invented in that linear river valley stage, and the institutions of the city are coeval, coincident with those that we call culture. In fact, many of our most important words come directly from the Greek and Latin terms for city, polis and civis. Civilization is the culture of cities. Civility is the way of life amongst individuals in a city. One wouldn't think so, but it is. Politeness is also the way of life that goes with city dwelling. Police is what you have to organize the city. Politics is your theory of running it. all of these derive from and must have been invented at that stage of aggregation. Now, the most important and impressive thing, perhaps, in the technology is the coming into being of what we now call the megalithic cultures. Somehow or other, primitive man got the trick of dragging around chunks of stone weighing 10 tons. I use that in general. Some of them only weighed a fraction of the ton. Some of them weighed more than 10 tons. But I am speaking of things like Stonehenge, the pyramids, these huge temples that you will see in the earliest Greek world, Minoan civilization, and so on. These come directly from the circumstances of the first advent of our linear city with its extremely seasonal basis. And it comes in simply for the same reason that Roosevelt invented the WPA projects in the 1930 Depression. The only way you can fairly distribute food is to make people work for it. In a primitive linear city, there is no economic work to do in the non-food growing season. You are eating and working roughly at the same times. During the winter part of the year, the non-flood, you see, the Nile, Tigris, Euphrates are much more seasonal than ordinary countryside because of the hydraulics of the process. So you have a flooding of the river, a very severe annual cycle. And you are stuck with no possibility of productive work for a good part of the year, and therefore the ruling class, those who have the power of leading the flock and of giving out the food in that part of the year, have the power to exact tasks, and those tasks, a very convenient form, a convenient WPA project, happens to be lugging these blocks of stone around and building what are rather non-functional buildings. The functional ones were already built. One needed a large sink for labor, because at this halfway stage, one needed to have the labor, but you didn't need any jobs to be done for the good of society. It's a weird, paradoxical position from our present vantage point, that the work and labor force far exceeded the need of the society for work. And this is really the social origin of the pyramids. Later I shall say something about the actual technology and the institutions of slavery. It is often misunderstood, as Thor Heyerdahl proved in his little book Aku Aku on the Easter Island statues. There is no great mystery to the actual technology of moving these chunks of stone around. Indeed, if you use more than a very few people on a very heavy stone, they tend to pull against each other. So the work is done with rather small teams of people, jogging and pushing and rocking, lifting on little rafts, and without wheels or pulleys or any technological inventions, sliding, rolling, rocking can do the job rather easily and rather quickly. And slavery was really very little used, because it is, in fact, a very inefficient form of labor. If you have slaves, then when you maltreat them and get too much work out of them, they die and you lose your capital. If you have free men, then nothing is lost if they die. So most of the workers were relatively free, and the slavery was, for the most part, in antiquity, the result of an extension of tribal capture, capture during warfare, usually being the thing that moved people around and put them into the labour force, maybe unwillingly, but much more with the status of free people than you would surmise from the much more recent history of the totally different matter of slavery in early America. That is, tends to be a quite different social phenomenon and different technology. We have now then gone through from the earliest beginnings to the coming of the technology. We have to admit we don't know why the change came over man to cease being a natural animal and to become a social, cultural being, but that entailed the birth of the city. It took place in just those areas of the earth where nature was hospitable enough for it to happen. They were the peculiar ones of those river valleys where you have the cities of Mohenjo-Daro on the Indus, the Nile civilization of the pharaohs, the Mesopotamian one that gave us Babylonian civilization and the Bible lands, and the Yellow River that gave birth to the ancient Chinese culture. All of these were the ones that happened. There may have been more later in the Mesoamerican region. There wasn't one in the Amazon River. It wasn't that suitable. The Mayan experience is a very much later evolution. So that is all there was. And from the invention of the written language about 3000 BC, one slowly and painfully gets the beginnings of something quite new, which we can follow as recorded history with the different techniques. And the next lecture then will take up the question of the evolution that begins with these river valley civilizations and takes us to the later phase of the Mediterranean. Our civilization was not, in fact, born in the Mediterranean lands. It is not a product of Greek, but of these earlier cultures first, and we shall have to follow that. Now, we can see, as we shall go through that, that it's only after the birth of language that science begins. There's all of this enormous and decisive technological change before. It happened. It was clear that there was no way back from it. And it tells us something extremely important about the tactics of social criticism of science and technology. It is the social change that happened first. That causes the technological adaption, and the technology causes the scientific understanding. At least it is so at the beginning. If we want to say it is anything different today, we shall have to make a case for it. Some case can be made. But this poses a problem right at the beginning to set the scene of the later development of science and technology. Okay, so much for that. Now I am ready to answer any questions, be they about the subject matter or organizational about the course. Who's got anything? I'll repeat them for the microphone. Yes. Yes?
About a year ago, I wrote about a theory that the invention of
sorry, I can't quite hear you. Now, I didn't quite get you. The coming of fire and cooking did what? I have no idea. I have no idea what effect that that would have. We just don't know that much about the coming of fire. And you see, in that range, man is such a rare animal that we only occasionally find traces, and these are still subject annually to such reinterpretation. The interaction of man's technology with the physical and evolutionary changes is still simply up for grabs. We know a little. Every year there are new ideas put forth. My guess, personally, would be that the technology was fairly stable and part of the man-animal for so many hundreds of thousands of years that it could affect the biological timescale very little. So far as we know, the biological timescale, though more rapid than the geological, is still damn slow. It takes a very long time. I mean, we are physically exactly like they were in the earliest Greek days, and it would be very difficult to tell any physical difference between us and the people of the Neolithic Revolution. Now, when we go back further than that, and we try to estimate just what was the amplitude of physical change before the Neolithic Revolution people 10,000 years ago, that had bodies and emotions exactly like ours. And further back, I don't know. Yes?
Are we going to get a larger room?
No, I'm going to get fewer people. My experience is that maybe half the people discover that this isn't really what they want to do and their timetable's all shot and they go away. If I absolutely must, and people persist to the third lecture, I'll get a bigger room. But it's going to be difficult, and I'll be loath to do it. And I'm happier with a smaller group. This is too many, not only too many papers to read and stuff to grade, but it is rather too many people to know, and I would hope to zap enough people to get to know them rather well. So I want a smaller group.
You mentioned how life was not all that Buddhist for people before the different kinds. But what were relations like between different packs of men who had grown? For example, if they lived in a place of abundance, would there actually be violence or rivalry between packs?
Well, we don't know. We have some experience of what the modern hunter-gatherers are like, and for the most part, they are fairly pacific people. But that is probably so because they're in this artificial modern world, and we generally see to it that there isn't one pack trespassing on another accidentally and unwillingly to the point where it's one or the other have to survive. Now, I mean, we can see from the nature of the stone artifacts that war is a very ancient human institution. So, certainly, there must have been some hostility. But that you see also in, packs of baboons meeting each other. You'll find something of this in the new sociobiology, but I think in general we simply don't have enough of the answers except to see that it is an extremely stable life at the hunter-gatherer stage, extremely resistant to any change, and extremely happy because it is stable. There are no demands on people. There is probably rather little language. There is probably very little directed activity necessary for life. What more can we say? And except that we don't know. If you're very interested in this, go into anthropology and archaeology and help work it out.
You mentioned that as man moved over the American continent, he disrupted and used the ecology in the area. Could you specify how the ecology changed? Was
Certainly.
It a totally different flora and fauna? And also, how does this compare to the way man is disrupting the environment today as he...
I'm asked how did this process of man exploding over the American continent disrupt the ecology? As I understand it, the chief thing was the addition of this new, highly predatory, large animal, man. This competed with the other megafauna and destroyed very rapidly the bulk meat market of the mammoths and the other large animals. when you have a whole biological spectrum from the very little to the very big, a chain of life, and you take away the top end, everything else adjusts. When you take away the big grazing animals, this then lets the flora creep up and grow in a way that it could not before. I mean, we assume that the rest of the life system, the ecosystem, had been stable, not for tens of thousands of years, but for hundreds of thousands of relative stability and very slow biological change. Here comes this new big mammal, rips up all the other big mammals, and the whole system then moves up and readjusts to a different life system. So that although man has moved on, little pockets get left behind, which of course become the point of origin for the indigenous peoples of the American continent, who adapt to the new ecological system and form small packs, rather than this wave of people spilling over and moving down. I mean, it's not a thick front. You mustn't imagine a battle line. These are groups of 100 people spaced 100 miles apart. And not just in a line, but in a whole band, and then gradually moving up, the most able being in front and getting the fresh land, and the others crowding up behind them and spilling through, until they come to an end in Patagonia somewhere, and the surge goes back down the line. It's a small number of people. There are less than 1 million people in the whole double continent involved in this. Now, how do I compare that with ecological damage today? In some ways very well, because this first explosion of mankind completely destroyed and changed man's habitat right at the beginning. So in that way, it is very similar. It is violent, it is global, it is big. But what we have now is so much power that the fragility has increased, and we can break the whole thing if we are not careful. It is perhaps a good parable for our age, but it is no exact parallel. Some of the ecological damage is very similar. I mean, if we take those non-sophisticated things we do that damage the ecology, like making the world fit for motor cars to live in, by spilling highways all over the place, that is very similar to the Neolithic Revolution of simply befouling the nest. And, of course, we adapted to the life afterwards. Man has progressed from the extremely hard and dirty life that came after the Neolithic Revolution to the point where it now begins to be somewhat pleasant again for quite a large fraction of the human population, not by any means all, but a much larger fraction than had existed in all of history, except before that Neolithic Revolution. But at the cost now of these very sophisticated things that can, in the twinkling of an eye, that biologically, that is in a few years, wreck up the atmosphere or the whole hydrosphere or pollute the genetic chains or any other things. Now, that is a power one didn't have before. This is a power that seems to be greater than nature's ability to fight back and heal after a while. But, going back again, the point is that nature, in the past, didn't just heal over and come back as it was, but man, as well as sort of being the special ethnocentric us, was just part of the environment and changed it, and it became a different ecological system with that sort of man in it. And man is a different biological system after the Neolithic Revolution than they were before. Before, it was a rather specialized and peculiar, highly predatory animal. Not the biggest, but a quite large one. After it, the power becomes much greater. Any other questions? Does anybody have general technical questions about the nature of the course? Those of you that didn't get it will get next week a a sheet that tells you when the essays are due and that there will be a midterm exam and a final exam.